Thank you, Your Honor. If I may reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal time.
Sure.
If it pleases the Court, good morning. This is a case
You're Mr. Timothy Lucas.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, yes. Timothy Lucas from Haley on behalf of Bruce Dewing, the appellant and plaintiff in the underlying action. With me is my colleague, Patricia Halstead. Your Honor, this is a case that arises from the district court's dismissal under 12b-6 of 16 underlying claims raised by my client that related to his employment and extension of stock options in a publicly traded gaming company located in both Reno and Las Vegas in terms of its actual operations, the company issuing the stocks as its headquarters in West Virginia and as a Delaware company. The focus of the claims themselves, of the 16 claims, 10 of them are contract claims, 6 of them are tort claims. The underlying dismissal by the district court, the Honorable Edward Reed, on June 3rd, 2002, seemed to focus and, as stated in the briefs, shifted the burden heavily onto the plaintiff relative to what I would characterize as admissibility of evidence claims and assumptions of what the facts would show, notwithstanding the pleadings that were filed by the plaintiff. And in each instance, I believe, showed that consideration, and if you read it as a prima facie case, accepting it as we must on a 12b-6 standard, the allegations are true and construed in the light most favorable to my client, would have led the court to the conclusion that, well, this case may not be the strongest case in the court's eyes. At least passes the threshold of a motion to dismiss and allows the court then to make the proper findings of fact. Because as the court well knows, even if there is an issue of law relative to contract interpretation, an issue of law is predicated upon some type of factual basis and analysis that the court must do. And at first blush on a motion to dismiss, all the court has before it is the claims and allegations that are set forth by the plaintiff, to which puts the defendant on notice of what those claims are and what is going to be the focus of discovery. I think that was adequately done in the 128-paragraph complaint that was filed before the court below.
Can I get past the 12b-6? I think we're okay in terms of how much has to be shown on a 12b-6, and I'd rather just get to the substance of what we're about here.
Sure.
And you may be able to help me understanding, helping you understand the practical consequences of registering or not registering the stock options. What's the benefit from registering?
The registration then allows a person who receives that option to freely sell it in the market.
And if they're not registered,
you have to have a number of very specific exemptions that even allows you to buy it in the first place. Then it is not sellable again. With few exceptions, for another year. However, in the intervening time, assuming that one of those exceptions would apply and allow you to buy the stock in the first place, you are immediately hit with an income distribution on the gain of that stock. For example, in my client's situation, where the stock at June 1st, and I'm going to use that number just because I did the calculations and I happen to know kind of where that comes out at. The stock was about $9.86 or 81 cents a share. The 100,000 shares that he could purchase were at $2.250 respectively. He would have had to have a purchase money of $225,000. You would deduct that then from 100,000 times 989 would give you about $760,000 in ordinary income, taxable at the highest rate, which is just below 40%, means that you have an immediate IRS bill of about
$370,000.
Yeah, okay. And that's true whether or not it's registered.
Correct, Your Honor.
All right, so
immediately.
The question, you got off track. The question was, what difference does it make if it's registered or not? And I think the point you're trying to make is that in order to pay the tax bill, he would have to sell some of it, in order to pay the taxes. If it's registered, he could sell it. If it's not registered, he could not.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, you didn't say that. You were rambling on.
Okay.
I apologize. Okay.
And at the end of the year, he can sell it. Is he restricted as to whom he may sell it if it's not registered at the end of that year?
After holding the stock for 1 year, is my understanding that he is not restricted on who he can sell it to.
I see. So the advantage and disadvantage really is that he can't realize his tax money. Yeah, he has to come up with his tax money from somewhere else for a year.
That's correct.
And the cost then is the cost of having to pay the tax a year before he can realize the sale, plus the risk of that it may go down in the intervening period.
That's correct.
Or the possible reward of it's going up.
Correct.
Okay.
And there are issues that are, I will say, it is mentioned of the key options in the record, and in general parlance, without referring to this case in particular, it's very common when you have the key employees that they will register the stock. That then allows them, because they have these large gains,
to
the brokerage houses who will then fund that difference immediately because they know they can turn the balance of that share so there's the person actually pockets something.
Okay, I understand.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes, Your Honor.
The district court, in its order, referred to something that appears to be a defined term. I'll quote it exactly. Quote, termination agreement and consulting agreement. And that is a defined term, apparently, because it's in caps, initial caps. Is the consulting agreement in the record?
It is not, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. It was referenced in the order that was pointed out in the opposition that it was not included. Again, it was pointed out in the briefs.
All right, may I ask a question?
Yes, Your Honor.
What contract do we look to determine if Dewey has stated a cause of action, a sufficient claim under 12b-6? We look to the agreement terminating the employment, which we don't have. Do we look to the non-qualified stock option agreements or all the agreements taken together?
Your Honor, it's a series of agreements. I would not call it one agreement. There was the first employment agreement, which is part of the excerpt on record. It's 2A tab. I'm sorry.
You have it.
It's
I'm sorry.
Exhibit A.
Yes.
The employment agreement, which is the June 1st, 1998, is actually between Mr. Dewey and the subsidiary, Speakeasy Gaming Reno, Inc. Okay, but yeah. on page 3 of the agreement, 43 in the excerpt of the record, it has the stock options, which makes reference that the publicly traded parent is the one that is giving that additional consideration. It speaks nothing about whether it would be restricted or not. I will grant that on the face of it, you look at it. It does talk about that these options will be exercisable for a period of 5 years from date of grant. Then the next agreement in time is the May 2000 termination agreement, which is Exhibit D, starts on page 58 in the excerpt of record. Under that agreement, it makes reference to the fact that the board of NTR had already granted options. Didn't require Mr. Dewey to sign anything. Did not require him to sign anything. Stated in the complaint, had already granted in 99 and 2000 the options. Okay. The termination agreement, which effectively terminated as general manager based upon his letter of resignation, makes reference that the $2 options were granted. Doesn't say anything about having to do an NQSO. Okay. In the third recital, it says, whereas the 250 would be subject to a form of NQSO. It's on page 58 of the excerpt of record. Then subsequently, another 6 months pass. I will tell you, the consulting agreement was executed, as I understand it, relatively contemporaneous in time with the termination agreement or shortly thereafter.
That's not in the record.
That's correct, Your Honor. It is stated in the pleadings.
That's the one that's not in the record.
The court makes reference to it in its order. I do not know why. The NQSOs then, as is stated in the complaint, were brought to Mr. Dewey by the vice president, and this is a key fact that for some reason the court seems to also miss in its analysis, by the general counsel. So the attorney for MTR, Mr. Rubin, brought those. That's paragraph 18 in the excerpt of record. I'm sorry, in the complaint, which is on page 9 and 10. Page 15 has his actual title, or excuse me, paragraph 15 on excerpt of record 9 actually has his title. The general counsel comes to Mr. Dewing after he's been queried several times about the promise to register, I want to sell my stock, and indicated, well, in order to do that, I need NQSOs. Okay. The NQSOs are not integrated. There's nothing that they can't be orally modified. He's simply told, as alleged in the complaint, which we have to accept as true, he's told that these are necessary in order to register the stock. Oh, you're on the registration, the Form S-8.
May I just ask another question?
Yes, Your Honor.
What consideration did you give in return for MTR's alleged promise to register your stocks?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, it wasn't per se raised below, but on the face of it, one can see that there are a change of terms when you do the NQSOs. For example, the NQSOs no longer grant my client 5 years from the date of issuance. They go to the date of termination by an interlineation, which on the face of it is only unilateral, but on paragraph 2, on page 51 of the excerpt, and on paragraph 2, page 54 of the excerpt, you'll see that my client no longer has a 5-year term for his options. They run only through the date of his consulting agreement, missing from the record. That's part of, though not specifically alleged within the complaint itself, but there are changes in my client's rights over time in the course of these agreements. It does all relate back, as stated in the complaint, my client was told that he would have a certain level of compensation at the time of his employment in 98. He was granted it in 99 without any signing. He was granted it in 2000, again, without any signing. It's only when it comes back to this point where he wants to get the options that they come up with the NQSO. And even by Mr. Rubin's standard and letter, in response to when Mr. Dewing finally does retain counsel in November of 2000 and says, you haven't registered them, the letter is not in the record, so I'm not going to explain all the things we're in, but in terms of the complaint, as it's stated, is that it demanded that the stock be registered, to which Mr. Rubin goes back and says, oh, you've always been on the registration statement, but we don't need to do it. We're taking you off. All the other key employees, we're keeping them on. They're all going to get the registered stock, which, in fact, happened on December 14th. Another key element that is in the complaint as alleged, it was not per se always a unilateral right for my client to have his shares registered, notwithstanding what happened to the key employee group, but was to have the same treatment as the key employee group, which it's beyond kind of the scope of the pleading. But back in 98, and as alleged throughout, there was a key employee group, and that is stated in the complaint itself, that he was always going to be treated the same and have his shares registered.
And on what basis do you make that assertion? Where does that right come from?
And, Your Honor, that's key options. That's on excerpt of record 8, paragraph 11. Talks about the key options. And then on every allegation, right claims for you here. On excerpt of record 12 through 15, paragraphs 33, 38, 48, and 53, as I understand, has all the same treatment party group.
And is that
because he was in the instrument.
And that's based on oral relations.
Consideration you're talking about, is it terms or is it promissory estoppel?
Both. One, as his on. For example, the NQSOs, on their face of them, give him and his termination. The termination agreement, and here's how.
You're answering the question.
would just like you to answer in two declarative.
Yes.
Or preparing for NPR's alleges.
Employment for my client and the execute agreement complaint. Well, that's what I was going to say. Without the development of the
NQSOs came.
Correct, Your Honor. But
he signed the agreement terminating point in the negotiations leading. Don't worry. Isn't that what you allege?
Correct, Your Honor. All right.
All consideration?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor. I'm sorry for not being concise on that
Thank
point.
You.
They missed the case law. You don't breach of an express contract. A tort claim, a covenant of good. Parties, which clients. He expects that he could use. Mean nothing.
And that's what
the company gave him. What. The original state court complaint that was removed. Very liberal for federal pleas, and that's what it's required to do.
Okay. You save some time when you're
on the other side.
I have a question for you. You represent the company, right?
Yes, John Desmond from my college.
Now, you'd be 6. That the consultant was never put in the. Now, the termination. That was months before Q.
But both
But just chronologically, that's correct. Complaint that leading up to the agreement, they don't worry, we'll register the stock. We have given, don't we?
Your Honor.
All right. In this agreement terminating any merger clause, all right, vision in the agreement, directly contradicted the presentation would register the stock.
I think there is, Your Honor, because the agreement and the employment group speak to doing as an obligation to enter into a non-qualified stock option agreement to come later.
Well, to come later. That,
right.
That didn't even exist at that time, did it? The obligation only referred to one of the two whereas clauses. The two.
I don't think.
Page
50. Okay, so Your Honor.
At least one. Non-qualified.
Well, actually, I read that the cease is modifying prior to, Your Honor. I don't believe it is.
Well, it looks to me like an ambiguity at best. In fact, I would, if it faced the complaint, disagree with the subject of that parenthetical. Put yourself at the exact moment in time that this agreement was signed, and taking every truth, that under Nevada law, nothing in this agreement that would have an oral promise that induced them, that they would.
I don't think that's correct, Your Honor, because he, 1998, he was under an existing into a non-qualified stock option agreement.
True, he was quote, in a.
Correct, an appropriate option agreement.
A non-qualified stock option agreement. It said an agreement. That's all it said.
I think there
isn't that.
I've not read Sullivan. I see the citation here in your brief. It's a Ninth Circuit case. Is it applying Nevada law?
I don't believe that it does, but I don't believe that we have a case in Nevada that discusses integration factors, Your Honor.
Yeah.
The district court below didn't rely on Sullivan, did it?
It did not. And the integration question was not briefed before the district court. Appellants never raised that these were not integrated agreements. That's an issue that's been raised for the first time on appeal. Getting back to the parole evidence question, very important point. In the Butch Lewis case, the Nevada Supreme Court, as a threshold matter, found that agreement to be far from a model of clarity. As the district court found in this case, and I think this court should find, the NQSO agreements are unambiguous on their face. So you really don't get to whether parole evidence of these alleged oral representations that took place between April and October of 2000 are admissible. As to the question of whether promissory estoppel, you were asking whether promissory estoppel may function as a consideration substitute here. Under the case of Van Cherry versus GNLV Corp., another Nevada Supreme Court case, the Nevada Supreme Court stated that promissory estoppel is not a substitute for an agreement between the parties, which is essentially what they're asking this court to do here. The offered parole evidence, which is directly at odds with the later writing, it cannot be used as a consideration substitute.
Let me ask a question. Maybe you can help clear this up in my own mind. You say non-qualified stock option agreements are complete. How do we know that unless we can decide the question of integration first?
I think you have to decide the question of integration first, which I think can be done as a matter of law under Sullivan.
If we decide it's not integrated, it clearly has to go back. This is a 12B6. It was sort of treated in my mind, and maybe I'm wrong about this, like a summary judgment. And
I don't believe that it was, Your Honor. I believe that the district court, if you look closely at the allegations of the complaint, I believe that the district court took all of those allegations in the best light to plaintiffs, as is required by 12B6, and applied an appropriate standard. I don't think the district court weighed evidence. There's nothing that could be elicited through discovery that would change the language of the contracts in this case, and I think that's the key point.
All right, thank you.
In terms of the intentional infliction of emotional distress claim, I think if you look at a long line of Nevada Supreme Court cases, in cases where the alleged emotional distress is not secondary to physical injuries, as it is not here, the Supreme Court has always required a higher showing of physical impact or physical injury. And in fact, in a 2000 case, Olivero versus Lowe, the Nevada Supreme Court articulated that in intentional infliction of emotional distress cases, it is a pleading requirement that physical impact or injury be in the complaint, not a proof requirement. And plaintiff doesn't say, yes, we've articulated a physical impact or injury. They just simply state that we've satisfied the elements of the case, but I submit to you that they have not.
Okay. Thank you. Any more questions from the bench? Thank you very much for your argument.
Your Honor, in regards to the question of ambiguity, as stated in part, though it's not, I don't think, in either brief, frankly, though it's on the face of the complaint, that the underlying agreements, which to the extent that there's an ambiguity, were drafted by, and it's not disputed as part of the record because it is in the complaint, were drafted by the company in this matter and presented by their general counsel to my client, particularly the NQSOs, which seems to be the sole reliance on this idea that there is no obligation in a total integrated package under any manner whatsoever that my client had any entitlement or expectation of entitlement to have his shares registered and to be able to benefit by that registration in terms of the value of those stock that would be issued pursuant to those options. The employment agreement, in terms of you want to see, is the defendant careful? The employment agreement prepared by the defendant has that integration clause and is carefully drafted. So to say that somehow they left it off or you should write it into this other agreement is simply inaccurate.
Where is that in the record?
Your Honor, that is excerpt of record 49, subparagraph D.
So your point is that in the original employment agreement, they knew how to put in an integration clause.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
They left that out of the...
Yeah, the general, somehow the general counsel missed it when he was having discussions of convincing my client why he needed to sign these NQSOs in October of 2000 in order to get the registration statement filed, which they ultimately then scratch his name off the list. He doesn't get the benefit of the bargain. That is a direct frustration in terms of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, both on a contract claim and on a tort claim. That is 10 of the claims that were dismissed by the district court just off the face of it. And that's the frustration of the bargain that my client had that he no longer has a remedy for by the court's analysis. In terms of the integration itself, just to close up with one last argument, it would appear that opposing counsel wants you to say that Sullivan, which is an MSJ case, so there was actually evidence presented, discovery conducted, should control. We do cite to the Truck Exchange in Nevada, which, though it's an old case, 1955, and also Sierra Diesel, that those are questions of fact in terms of is a agreement integrated, and in this case, we actually have a series of agreements that need to be looked at.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much for your argument. The case of Doing versus MTR Gaming Group is now submitted.